You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of August, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme: a deadly explosion rocks the centre of Bangkok. At least 16 people have been killed and many more injured. We'll have analysis in studio from my guests Sebastian Borger and Axel Threlfall. We'll also discuss the Bundestag vote this week on a new 86 billion euro Greek rescue plan. With Angela Merkel pulling out the stops to back the bailout, we'll ask if she'll succeed. All that plus EU migration, the positives and pitfalls of sky-high executive pay, and the philosophy behind Amazon's competitive workplace culture. That's all to come here on Midori House. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are journalists Sebastian Borger, a London-based correspondent for German media, and Axel Threlfall, editor-at-large for Reuters. Welcome to you both. And we begin in Bangkok, where a large explosion rocks the centre of the city today near the Erawan Shrine in the capital's busy Chitlom district. At least 16 people have been killed, dozens reportedly injured. Police say a bomb strapped to a motorcycle exploded, yet there have been no claims so far of responsibility. Axel Threlfall, I mean, obviously, you know, the details so far are fairly sketchy, but this is bad news for Thailand, isn't it?
Yeah, it is bad news. As you say, Steve, details are still coming through, but compared to some of the trouble that we've seen over the past few years, small pipe bombs in the city, this is something on a slightly bigger scale. We've heard that it might have been specifically aimed at the tourist industry. I believe about four or five, don't quote me on those figures, were tourists in the capital. So to directly hit Thailand's economy, Bangkok's economy, of course, we know that in the south, the separatists, the Muslim insurgency are making their demands known. We've heard that for a while. Could this be something bigger from them in the capital? It remains to be seen. But by all accounts, right now, it seems to be hitting the tourist trade. It happened near the Erawan Shrine, as you said, and of course that directly hits Thailand's economy.
Sebastian Borger, Thailand has had a curious period over the last 18 months or so, because it's had this bloodless coup that certainly many people in Bangkok, those who are sort of well off in Bangkok, have welcomed and celebrated. And life in the city has pretty much carried on as normal all throughout that, hasn't it?
It has, yes. And I mean, that's why it's even more shocking. I mean, we're used to terrible news from Iraq and from Syria and from Sudan and from Somalia, but Thailand really wasn't so much on our radar. And it's difficult because we know little so far, but you know, it's clearly, it must be aimed at the tourist trade, and that's terrible news for a country which so much relies on it.
We're going to be covering this story in much more detail on the Monocle Daily later on tonight at 2200 with our team in Bangkok, and hopefully things should be slightly clearer now. I want to move on to Germany now, Axel. The Bundestag is going to vote this week on a new 86 billion euro rescue plan for Greece. Angela Merkel has already rescheduled trips to Italy and Brazil in order to spend more time in Berlin to fight for the plan. She also went on state TV last night to make her case. Do you think that she's going to manage to persuade enough of her supporters inside the Bundestag to vote with her?
Well, I mean, and this is the big question, and this is probably more Sebastian's thing, but yeah, she's clearly trying to reassure lawmakers ahead of this vote on Wednesday. She is saying, she spoke to Christine Lagarde of the IMF, and the IMF is on board. She's coming out with some astonishing quotes. In fact, I've got one of them here. Lagarde said the IMF will will do this. I have no doubt that what she said will become a reality, according to Merkel. So very much putting the ball into Lagarde's court, very much putting the pressure, it seems, on Lagarde. You know, will she persuade a number of the Conservatives and the CDU and the CSU to come round? It remains to be seen. There's been talk of bullying tactics by some of the party whips, and that's clearly upsetting a lot of the Conservatives in the party. It doesn't actually matter, I believe, because the SPD, and again, Sebastian will know this, the SPD and the Greens are going to support this anyway, so it's going to get through, it seems, right, Sebastian?
It's absolutely solid. There's no doubt about the outcome. It is very interesting to see how much she will have to fight and how much she does fight. And I think the way she's gone into it suggests two things. Firstly, she believes in the deal. Secondly, she's getting a little bit desperate about the lack of support on her own backbenches because she can't afford to just soldier on like that and increasingly rely on the Social Democrats. I mean, she's always tried to be the Chancellor above the waters, and of course the Germans really like that. You know, you have to be be beyond party, so to speak. But in the end, she needs the support of the Conservatives, and there is real trouble on the backbenches.
Axel, you mentioned Christine Lagarde there and how Angela Merkel wants her support. But also Christine Lagarde, over the past few days, has been reaffirming the IMF's belief that Greece can't pay back its debt. Now, I say reaffirming the IMF's belief that's happening. I must say, I can't remember the last time that Christine Lagarde herself actually said this.
Yeah, and you know, Sebastian's quite rightly waving his arms around in despair.
Exactly.
Yeah, look, I mean, the IMF thinks this debt is unsustainable. They want to see decent debt relief from the Eurozone
right
states.
Well. It is unsustainable. It can't be paid back.
No, yeah. Well, that's true. But the interesting thing, of course, is that both Merkel and even this terribly Eurosceptic Finnish foreign minister,
Timo Soini.
That's right. Both say no haircut, but we can do all sorts of things with the extension the loan, with the interest rates. In other words, a haircut.
No haircut.
They can work it out, and they will work it out.
But come into my salon and I'll do you something new.
Well, exactly.
And we should say the Finnish Grand Coalition has approved this. They approved it last week. So, yes, this guy, the foreign minister or the interior minister or whoever he is.
Timo Soini is the foreign minister.
And it's always good to hear other voices in the Northern European.
Well,
don't rely on Berlin.
I know, but don't cling too much to Timo Soini as your voice. I'm just saying.
I find it interesting because the guy.
His party, the Finns, or it used to be the True Finns, is the sort of the national front of Finland.
I agree. I heard him speak at a Tory party conference, and I was three, 4 years ago. I was astonished that they let him in, but you can see he's been in power in office now for 3 or 4 months, and he basically now talks exactly like mainstream conservative politicians in Holland, in Germany, and in Austria. So that's the disciplining force of having having an office in government.
You know, I think the other thing, just very quickly, that we need to talk about is this from the Greek side. I mean, so everyone signs off on this, but how do you implement this bailout in Greece without a majority? And this goes to the trouble Syriza finds itself in, Tsipras finds himself in, and this is getting worse and worse. It looks like we're going to have this no-confidence vote now.
We're heading for new elections, aren't we?
I think without a doubt we're heading for new elections, yeah. So the question has to be, and we're going to be sitting here in a month or however many months' time, we're going to be saying, okay, how do we do this now without a majority?
But surely then the issue then will come back to debt restructuring. It has to, doesn't it? Because you say there's going to be new elections, but do we have to keep on having elections in Greece until we get a result that both the Germans and the Finns are happy with?
No. The elections will bring Tsipras back to power. That's the interesting thing. I think, you know, based on, I'm maybe overly optimistic, but based on the referendum result and the subsequent complete turnaround of Tsipras' government, he seems to have a hold on Greek society now. And, you know, let's be positive about what Merkel has said, a haircut in all but name. There is finally movement. I mean, couldn't believe it. It is happening. They have understood something about economics at last.
I mean, I agree with Sebastian that yes, Tsipras probably will be returned. I mean, we've got to remember PASOK has said they will not vote for him, and this confidence motion, I think New Democracy have said the same thing. But yes, he probably will come back, and that's what we need. We need the shakeout. We need a little bit of stability, and then we can move forward.
Okay, I want to stick with Europe, and this story involves both Germany and Greece, but is slightly different. Migration is, of course, one of the bigger stories in the headlines these days. Angela Merkel has said that refugees in the EU will preoccupy Europe much, much more than the issue of Greece and the stability of the euro. Germany this year has received more than 150,000 first-time asylum applications, with 258,000 applications in total. Meanwhile, the mayor of Goslar, a town in West Germany, says he wants to take in more asylum seekers. This is, he says, to boost his town's shrinking population and economy. Sebastian Borger, is the mayor of Goslar a rather minor political figure, but is this the exception rather than the rule when it comes to German politicians and their attitude towards asylum seekers?
It's a fascinating story. It is the exception, yes. Although I do think in a lot of these smaller towns, people take a very pragmatic view, and you know, they can see that they've got houses empty here, there, and everywhere. Particularly in small, more rural places like Goslar. You said it's in West Germany. Remember, it's only about 10 kilometers from the former border to the east. It's in one of those places where terrible infrastructure. I happen to know it because we had a family gathering there 2 years ago to celebrate one of my ancestors who left Goslar.
one of the 2,000 leaving every year, right?
He shouldn't. Well, he was in the 90s. Century, so it doesn't quite come. Anyway, what I wonder about is more like, well, why does the German population leave places like Goslar? Because there are no jobs. Mm. Now, you know, you can have all the multiculturalism you like. You need jobs. You need to employ people. You need to, or you need to give them something to be entrepreneurial about, but that's difficult in a dying
time. And okay, so that's the one thing. There are no jobs for these people. He wants these people to, and I think sort of 30 or 40 or 50 every month or so are staying now in Goslar. But he makes a good point, actually, this mayor, and he in a sense trying to help solve the problem. The big cities, they have nowhere for these people to live. He has houses, he has apartments in Goslar where they can live. So yes, very pragmatic.
And it's interesting, Axel, isn't it, when you look at you compare it to what's happening here in the UK, where we have a Prime Minister who talks about swarms of migrants trying to break into Britain, was his recent one. Our Foreign Minister was talking about marauding African migrants coming across Europe for a better way of life. Mm. There's a very different sense of tone in the UK, isn't there?
Well, there is a different sense of tone, but remember, a big part of the kickback in Germany is because a lot of these asylum seekers are deemed to be coming from countries that are safe, and not countries where people are being persecuted, where they're being tortured. And I think that a large part of the kickback in Germany is because of that. I don't know if you agree with that, Sebastian.
Well, can we just first of all say it's shameful rhetoric? It's shameful rhetoric. And I thought there was a brilliant interview on the BBC yesterday with a refugee from Nazi Germany, born in 1933, who came here on one of the last Kindertransporte. And she said, I'm start, this is the country I love beyond anything you can imagine, and I'm starting to get ashamed of it. I really think David Cameron ought to know better. Interestingly, I've researched asylum, the policies towards asylum seekers here, which of course is much more pragmatic than the rhetoric suggests. And interestingly, of course, they explicitly in the British Home Office say you will not be housed in London or the South East. In other words, don't think you can illegally work here in Britain. You'll be sent somewhere out into the sticks, basically the Goslars of the UK.
But the way that was done, certainly previously, created all sorts of problems. You had people stuck in old tower blocks in Glasgow that had been condemned, but oh well, that's fine, we can put asylum seekers in there.
But they wouldn't be, well, Glasgow, of course, is a big place, but the small towns have both a chance, like the Goslar mayor argues, and also, of course, problems. I mean, I've spoken to a Norwegian friend who in a place of 1,500 people suddenly has 150 asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. 10% of the population. That's
and you know, the point you raised, the difference in rhetoric. I mean, one of the things, and you started this segment by mentioning what Merkel had said. You know, this is the next major European project. You know, can we talk as one voice in Europe? And you know, by the looks of it, absolutely not. I think this resurgence, this every man for himself mentality, is clear for everyone to see. There was a great piece by a Reuters journalist. Out of Brussels, he was traveling in Europe, and he was at some sports festival just outside of Rome, and when the Italians stood up and sang their national anthem, the French did, the Germans did it, and then they did the Ode to Joy for the European, and everyone sat down and sort of looked glum-faced.
Well, because
but no
one people, feels European people don't right know now. The words, and they are, I can tell
is that
you,
what
they,
it is?
They are positively weird. I've sung it, but anyway, yeah.
Yes, I think the idea that we're all going to be singing Ode to Joy is perhaps
far-fetched.
But that doesn't mean that we won't necessarily feel a bit more European at some stage, perhaps. Sebastian, on this point then of, you know, if it is all 28 nations for themselves when it comes to the issue of asylum and immigration, do you think we're going to see examples of other countries or indeed other towns or cities like Goslar following the example that Sweden has for the past 10, 15 years of saying, you know what, we're going to take 100,000 refugees from Syria because A, it's the right thing to do, and B, actually, we think it's quite good for the country?
As I was saying, I think there is a mood in Germany. There is obviously always there are always those who say, goodness me, foreigners, and we can't afford it and all that. But I think there is an interesting and maybe growing part of the population which can see the arguments for having young hungry hungry in the sense of the success, wanting success for themselves and their families, people in their country, in a country which, let's not forget, is dying out. You know, when you look at the demographic trend, that's, by the way, a difference to Britain as well, where Britain is still growing quite rapidly in population.
Well, you say it's growing quite rapidly, but in Britain, as indeed in many other countries, actually in Europe, there is a problem with an aging population. So even if the population is growing, the fact is that, you know, we need, you know, economically, we need, it could be argued, we need more migrants in here so we can pay for the pensions of the people
Absolutely.
Who are here already.
And, you know, yes, aging population in Europe. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we look at Japan, but Europe, I mean, this...
Portugal.
Italy. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. So yes, I you know, I'm very much with Sebastian here. I mean, there is this need for success-hungry young people.
Okay. On that note, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests, Axel Threlfall and Sebastian Borger. When we're back, we're talking about pay, and we're also talking about working conditions at one of the most famous companies in the world. Stay tuned.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses, and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Axel Threlfall and Sebastian Borger. Let's talk now about executive pay. It's been reported that the average FTSE 100 chief executive earns a salary more than 183 times that of a regular full-time employee. Just 5 years ago, CEOs earned a mere 160 times more. Axel Threlfall, is this a sign of strong, healthy capitalism, or perhaps the exact opposite?
Look, I don't know if I want to take much of a stand on this one, but we're looking at average £5 million or something for CEOs now in the FTSE 100, £26,000-£27,000 for the average employee. Everyone picks up on these, what do we call them, these pay ratios. Mm. And that number is now up to 180. Some companies, by the way, in the FTSE, it's at 700-800, which is remarkable. Look, how big an effect does a CEO have on the company? How big an effect can the CEO have on the company? It comes down to that. If the CEO, if under that CEO's tenure, you see the share price quadruple, if you see the CEO of a company like Tesco, Sir Terry Leahy, I think of, open thousands of new stores, employ tens of thousands of people, you know, I think it's warranted. It's when failure is rewarded that this becomes a problem.
And that is the issue, isn't it? Because when you look at CEO pay generally, you know, failure is rewarded. Not about sort of, oh, well, the share price has gone up, so CEO pay has gone up. Actually, the share price went down, but somehow still this guy's pay rise went up. And actually, he got a bonus as well.
I think there is still way too much of that. There are guidelines coming in back in 2013 when all the companies had to provide this one number and then shareholders got a bigger say. I think boardrooms are thinking a lot harder about how the compensation committees, about how they award salaries and how they award bonuses, etc. It's happening, but it is happening very slowly, I'll give you that.
Sebastian Borger, does this matter?
Axel is doing a very good job in defending the indefensible, as far as I'm concerned. I think it's absolutely obscene. And look, when you talk to, which I do because I have a 17-year-old, when you talk to young people who are caught up in this Corbyn mania, in other words, the race for the new Labour leader here in Britain, where a left-winger who we thought was beyond the pale in all sorts of, with all sorts of odd opinions, is now the front runner. Why is that? Because they are, these 15, 16, 17, 20, 25-year-olds are confronted with completely obscene and impossible stuff happening in society. What we keep telling them is, oh, well, that's just the way capitalism works. Sorry, no, it isn't. Mm-hmm. The Prime Minister earns, please correct me if I'm wrong, £143,000, running the sixth largest economy in the world, in charge of atomic weapons. I cannot for the life of me see why someone with certainly good skills of some sort, like Martin Sorrell, the chief executive of the PR conglomerate, WPP, earns £42.9 million. I can't understand it. And nor can the vast majority of people. And let me add some, the last thing I'll say to, on this is, we know from a raft of research projects that unequal societies equal unhappy societies. We've got to do something about it.
Yeah. Axel, it's interesting that there was a moment 7 years ago where what Sebastian just said, that everyone would have been around the table nodding their heads going, yes, actually something must be done about this, because this has been the most awful crash. We've realised that none of this is sustainable. But that moment went.
It went. But don't get me wrong. You know, please don't misunderstand me here. I'm certainly not defending the £43 million or whatever it is that some of these people are being paid. I do like little bits of what we're seeing, the way boards are becoming a little bit savvier now when it comes to awarding, making these massive awards, the way shareholders are able to stand up and say, no, you are not going to pay this guy this much money. I do like the way that is going. That's the point I'm making. Yes, it is. It is. It is. It is glacial. But, let's. Who was it? Burberry, wasn't it, last year? Shareholders came out and said, no, he's not getting it. But he got it in the end, didn't he?
Well, there we are.
Okay. Glacial, and we need to make it work, right?
Indeed. Okay, well, let's move on to our final story, which just sort of links in with all of this. At least this is a company that has been relatively successful, to say the least. But there was a fairly devastating portrait of the American web giant Amazon published at the weekend by the New York Times. The investigative piece portrays Amazon as a highly competitive yet brutal place to work. Jeff Bezos, Amazon's founder and CEO, has responded by saying he didn't recognise the workplace portrayed in the article, and that he would not tolerate the shockingly callous management practices it described. Sebastian Borger, some of those shockingly callous management practices included people who had long-term illnesses and were told that they were not pulling their weight, and so were going to be let go. It included people who had were looking after sick relatives and were then told
pregnant
they were
women being sacked, that kind of thing. I mean, that kind of reaction tells you all about all you need to know about these people who are clearly completely removed from reality. This guy is what, the fifth richest man in the world? Well, maybe he should get down to the nitty-gritty and look at his managers and fire either them or himself.
I'm with Sebastian. I mean, look, I found this piece shocking.
It was astonishing.
The cult that has been built up within this company. I mean, just some of the things that you read. When you hit the wall, climb the wall.
When you heard someone say, nearly every person I worked with, I saw cry at their desk.
When you're shooting for the moon, the work is really challenging. I mean, come on, the secrecy, the mystery, these what was it?
The worst
performance
thing was
improvement algorithms.
What my personal trainer says when I once again
The worst thing was, and, you know, in some ways it would be quite interesting to see what would happen if you introduce it to other workplace, but the anytime feedback tool where you can secretly dob in your colleagues and say, actually, this person wasn't performing that well. And you can do that secretly
and
to
fact,
their
boss.
And in
fact, it was one of these new mothers who came in early, left early to pick up her child from childcare, who was dobbed in because these guys didn't realise how early she was coming in, and they were complaining about how early she was leaving. Yeah, I mean, it's appalling, this. Absolutely appalling. And I do hope there will be a massive backlash.
Well, you say you hope there'll be a massive backlash. Sebastian, are we going to boycott Amazon? Because actually, let's face it, it has become the everything store, and everyone uses it all around the world. And part of these new projects that they're doing, which are pushing their workers to the limit and beyond the limit, include being able to get us, you know, a book or a cup or whatever we want like that.
Very interesting, because I seriously looked at boycotting the company 2 years ago, whenever it was, when
they
were
paying taxes here.
Well, exactly. Same. I mean, it's part of the same phenomenon. We are a law unto ourselves. We don't care about labor laws. We don't care about tax laws. again, sorry if it, to repeat myself, that's the kind of capitalism that people don't want to see anymore. And but try and boycott Amazon, you'll have grave difficulties.
I mean, just to be clear, I mean, when I talk about a backlash, I'm not personally talking about boycotting this company. I'm talking about a backlash against these sorts of practices within companies. Well, let's just come down
but
hard
is,
on
but
that.
Is, but it is as a consumer, what do you do?
Well, no, but sorry, we don't have quite time for that. But it is interesting, Axel, just very briefly, that Bezos hasn't just responded to this by saying nothing. He has said, I don't recognise this, I'm going to investigate.
Well, hopefully he's going to investigate, root it out and fire some people, right?
Okay, well, we'll see whether they do that. My favourite bit from the Anytime Feedback tool, you can sample text. I felt concerned about his inflexibility and openly complaining about minor tasks. You don't even have to write that, you can just press send. there we are. Thank you very much to Sebastian Borger and Axel Threlfall. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Elena Nikolucheva and Eugenia Alinskaya. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Do tune into The Daily at 2200 hours with more on Bangkok. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening.